Iran's president tells his Russian counterpart Tehran will give a more forceful response to any fresh Israeli attack on his country's interests. The United Nations says Israel's genocide in Gaza has killed 10,000 women so far, leaving over 19,000 children orphaned. And Hamas says recent reports about Israel torturing Palestinian detainees reaffirms regime's war crimes and genocide against the people of Gaza. Hello everyone and welcome to World News. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says any further Israeli aggression against the country will be met with a more powerful response. We discussed the Islamic Republic's position following Tehran's punitive attack on Israel earlier in our news review program. And I welcome everyone to a news review program where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Iran's president has reiterated Tehran's position that it will give a more forceful response to any fresh Israeli attack against Iran's interests. Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks in a phone conversation with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. He hailed Russia's support for Iran's retaliatory operation against Israel. Raisi denounced the West's opposition to the attack and urged U.S. and its allies to stop supporting Israel's genocide in Gaza if they truly want to de-escalate tensions. Putin, for his part, hailed Iran's move against Israel as the best possible response to its aggression against the Iranian embassy in Syria. He said that Iran is one of the pillars of regional security and stability and slammed destabilizing moves by the U.S. and its allies in the region. Joining us now for our news review program is Khaled Barakat, spokesperson for Masar Badid movement out of Vancouver, Canada, and Paul Larudi, activist, historian, and author, joining us out of Berkeley. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there in Vancouver with you, Mr. Barakat. Good to have you on the program here. Now, many world leaders, especially, sir, you're welcome, especially in the West, knew how important this move was by Iran to respond to and protect itself from an attack on its diplomatic premises. It would be a horrible precedent if this did not take place. You won't hear these Western leaders condone it. In fact, many have come out and condemned it, but almost all of them, I'm positive, are really on board with the fact that this could not have just been left alone, and really Israel needed to see a response for what it did.
Absolutely. I think the Iranian strike is welcomed by the vast majority of the people of the region and worldwide, because the world has, they know that Israel have been committing crimes against Iran, aggression after aggression, assassinations of its scientists. Israel is the aggressor here, and all these crimes, Israel thought that it can get away with it, just like every time they strike against an Iranian interest or Iranian, a facility. The massacres actually that took place sometime targeting civilians in a rally in Iran. Everyone knows that the Mossad is behind it, and U.S. agents, and yet Iran did not respond. And when Israel attacked the Iranian embassy, that was the limit. Iran said that the strategic patient theory is not going to work this time. There will be a zero tolerance, attacking Iranian territories. And so the response is legitimate. It's a moral act, and it was supported definitely by the people of the region.
Your thoughts, Paul, on Russia backing Iran's retaliatory move, as you very well know, both for quite some time been branded as the bad guys by the West, both have been victims of Western double standards on so many fronts, especially diplomatically, and both have exercised to a great deal or had violations of their rights, of their patience, of their trust by the West countless times.
Well, what Iran is going through, of course, Russia is also going through. The assault against Russia by NATO and through its proxy in Ukraine. In the case of Iran, the proxy is Israel, and Israel is doing this also for its own interests, as with Ukraine as well. It's doing it thinking that it can drag the United States and the West along with it in order to eliminate Iran as a major adversary. It's a desperate move by Israel, because Israel is now losing. And furthermore, Israel is in a much worse position than it was prior to October 7th. I mean, its relationship to the rest of the world was in many cases friendly, and it was seen as a partner by many nations. It's no longer seen that way by those same nations. Nations have suspended economic activity, academic activity, all sorts of relationships with Israel. Israel is now isolated, and furthermore, it's losing its battle with Hamas. They are shocked at this. So it's despised, and it's shown its weakness as hundreds of thousands of Israelis have left the country for good. So, in the case of the relationship between Iran and Russia, they have a common interest in working together.
All right, Jasmine, thank you for both joining us on the program. Stay safe to both of you. Khaled Abadik out there joining us there from Vancouver, Canada, and Paul DeRudy joining us from Berkeley, California. This brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister also called Tehran's military operation against Israel limited and a minimal response, reassuring in case of any further escalation by the regime that Israel will receive an immediate, decisive, and major blow. Hossein Emir Abdullahian made the remark in a phone conversation with his Japanese counterpart, Yoko Kamikawa. He said military bases and intelligence centers that were hit by Iran were used for the regime's recent airstrikes on Tehran's diplomatic mission in Damascus. Iran's top diplomat stressed attack on Israel was a punitive measure in the framework of Tehran's legitimate right to self-defense. For her part, Kamikawa reiterated her country's condemnation of the Israeli airstrikes on the consular section of Iran's embassy in Syria, saying any aggression on diplomatic premises is unacceptable. She also called on all parties to exercise restraint in a bid to avoid further tensions in West Asia. An Iranian official says all hypersonic missiles used in the country's recent retaliatory operation against Israel hit their targets with precision. Comment was made by Saeed Mojtaba Abtahi, the Secretary General of International Conference on Supporting the Palestinian Intifada. He said major world powers, including the U.S., the U.K., France, and Germany, helped Israel against Iran's retaliatory operation. Abtahi said they had defined 8 anti-missile defense zones in the region to thwart Iran's operation, but failed to do so. He noted, on the whole, 10 countries helped Israel during Iran's operation True Promise. Abtahi said Iran used ballistic and cruise missiles, as well as drones, to punish Israel for its attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria earlier this month. In the Iranian capital, Tehran, a group of university students gathered in front of the Jordanian embassy to condemn its government for assisting Israel to repel Iranian attacks against the regime.
We are here to condemn preventing the entry of Iranian drones into the airspace of Israel by Jordan.
Any kind of cooperation with the enemy by any country is legally considered complicity, and that is why we have gathered here to condemn providing assistance to the Israel regime.
Israel has tried to portray its army as an invincible force in the region. It has tried to send a message that no country can attack them, and if they do, Israel will crush them. But, as Brigadier General Salami said, we have now changed the rules of the game.
All these years, Jordan has helped Israel oppress the Palestinian people, but they should know that one day their own youth will not allow them to continue these crimes in cooperation with the Zionist regime. I want to tell Israel that their days of impunity are over. Israel, you have no right to bully anyone, not Palestine, not Iran, or any other nation. You can no longer make threats. You have no right to bully and you have no right to attack. If you do so, you will be destroyed.
Nations across the region have widely welcomed Iran's massive retaliatory operation against the Israeli regime. Our Turkey correspondent has spoken to people on the streets how they see Iran's unprecedented missile and drone attack against Israeli-occupied territories.
Iran had every right to do what they did, because any other country, if their embassy or consulate was flattened, they will have the same reaction. If Turkey's, any consulate or embassy for Turkey or any other country, I believe they would do the same. Iran had every right to do what they have done. If Israel to bomb any of Turkish consulates or embassies around the world, I believe Turkey will not be quiet about it, and they will do much, much more than what Iran has done.
I am absolutely against targeting other countries' consulate. I do not support the attack on Iran's consulate at all, and I tell Israel not to dare try something like this with Turkey, because we are the descendants of Ottomans, and our response will be very strong.
If Israel attacked Turkey's consulate, Turkey would not stand silent. Of course, the response would be strong, and that would be a legitimate response when another country attacks you.
This is seen as a conflict between two countries, but if someone attacked me, I have a legitimate right to respond. I want the end of Israel, but this seems like an unrealistic dream.
Iraqi people leaders have hailed Iran's retaliatory operation against Israel, which came amid Tel Aviv regime's war on Gaza. They say attack was legitimate and within the rights to self-defense after failure of the international community to condemn the deadly Israeli airstrike on Iran's consulate. Muslim Salim reports out of Baghdad.
After days of anticipation, Iran unleashed a barrage of missiles and drones against Israeli targets in the occupied territories. The legitimate response came after Israel attacked Iran's consulate in Damascus on April 1st, violating all international laws and conventions.
Iran's response comes within the international laws, specifically Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, which gives Iran the legitimate right to defend its national security. The Iranian attack on Israel has changed the geopolitical map in the region, and it was a strong warning to the evil regime.
The Iraqi people, as well as resistance leaders, hailed the Islamic Republic for the unprecedented response, dubbed Operation True Promise, which was within the inherent right of self-defense that entitles any country to protect its diplomatic institutions. Iran's retaliation came after the UN Security Council failed to condemn Israel's attack, which killed 7 members of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps.
The resistance and the people of Iraq surely stand by the Islamic Republic of Iran amid the failure of international community and the UN Security Council to condemn the Israeli attack on the Damascus consulate. Iran had all the rights to defend itself and respond with proper means and timing.
The significant operation clearly shows that Iran will not hesitate to take action against any threat to its citizens and institutions. Now, with its capabilities and military evolution, Iran has significantly changed the rules of battlefield in modern times. Iran's retaliatory operation, which came after a long time of strategic patience in the face of Israeli's brutalities, shows that the Tel Aviv regime's days of hit and run are over, and Iran does not hesitate to exact a devastating revenge on its enemy despite its all-out Western support. Muslim Salem, Baghdad.
But now, moving on to Gaza, where more death and destruction has been reported on day 193 of Israel's genocidal war. At least 11 people, most of them children, are killed in an attack on the Al-Maghazi refugee camp in central Gaza. 9 Palestinians lost their lives in a strike on a police vehicle in Gaza City, and 5 civilians were killed in the southern city of Rafah. Meanwhile, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says it's found unexploded 1,000-pound bombs inside of schools after Israel pulled its troops out of Khan Yunis. U.S.-Israeli genocidal campaigns claimed over 33,800 lives since October 7th. Most of the victims have been women and children. The Gaza health system has almost collapsed as hospitals have not been spared from Israel's attacks. The regime is also using famine as a weapon of war. Some 2 million Gazans are struggling to get access to food amid Israeli restrictions on the entry of humanitarian aid. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has issued a statement in reaction to reports about the Israeli regime torturing dozens of Palestinian detainees before releasing them on Monday.
The horrific testimonies documented by a large number of Palestinians recently released by the Zionist occupation army, including children as young as 12 years old, which confirmed their exposure to various types of torture, ill-treatment and deprivation of health care, is an affirmation of the brutality of this criminal army and the violations it commits against defenseless civilians within the framework of war crimes and genocide against our people in the Gaza Strip.
Statement came after Gaza's Crossings Authority released testimonies of some 150 recently freed Palestinian detainees uncovering their painful ordeal during detention. It called on international human rights bodies to take action to reveal the fate of thousands of Palestinians kidnapped during the Israeli raids across Palestinian territories. UN investigators say Israel is blocking a probe into Hamas's October 7th operation against the regime by obstructing their access to witnesses of that attack. That's according to Navi Pillay, former UN rights chief who now chairs the probe team, which is also investigating Israel's genocidal onslaught on Gaza. Another investigator says Israel is not only not cooperating with them, but is actively obstructing their efforts to receive evidence from witnesses. Member of the inquiry team also said that some of the digital evidence of the incident has also disappeared from the internet. Thanks for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you, early in the morning. With you, at midday. With you, till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
By continuing to arm the Zionist regime as it engineers a famine in Gaza, the U.S. regime is disregarding its own domestic law, which prohibits the provision of military assistance to states that block humanitarian aid provided by Washington. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The electronic intifada wrote, over the past 6 months in Gaza, the Zionist regime has killed civilians on an industrial scale, turned hospitals into strategic military targets, and food into a weapon of war. Blatantly violating basic principles of the laws of war, the Zionist regime has deployed the language of international humanitarian law as a form of humanitarian camouflage, in the words of independent UN expert Francesca Albanese, in the furtherance of its genocidal campaign. In her new report titled Anatomy of a Genocide, Albanese says that one of her key findings is that Israel's executive and military leadership and soldiers have intentionally distorted Jus in Bello principles, subverting their protective functions in an attempt to legitimize genocidal violence against the Palestinian people. Jus in Bello refers to the conditions under which states may legitimately resort to war. It regulates the conduct of parties engaged in an armed conflict. International humanitarian law, according to the International Committee of the Red Cross, is synonymous with jus in bello. It seeks to minimize suffering in armed conflicts, notably by protecting and assisting all victims of armed conflict to the greatest extent possible. In the absence of such accountability measures for the past and ongoing rights violations and enabled by decades of impunity, Israel's total war on Palestinians in Gaza is also a war on the principles of international law, the impact of which will surely be profound. Albanese report finds that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating Israel's commission of genocide is met, while arguing that its conduct complies with international humanitarian law. According to Albanese, the Zionist regime's actions have been driven by a genocidal logic integral to its settler colonial project in Palestine, signaling a tragedy foretold. She explains that settler colonialism is a dynamic, structural process and a confluence of acts aimed at displacing and eliminating indigenous groups, of which genocidal extermination and annihilation represents the peak. The genocidal logic underpinning Israel's violence in Gaza, now at an annihilationist peak, is not new, and the Zionist regime's past practices, including persecution and discrimination, lay the groundwork for the current eliminationist stage. The Zionist regime has advanced its settler colonial project through military occupation and various repressive measures, according to Albanese. This has involved construing Palestinians as a security threat to justify their oppression and decivilization, namely, the denial of their status as protected civilians, she adds. The denial of Palestinians' status as protected civilians has reached its most extreme point in the genocide currently unfolding in Gaza, during which more than 33,000 Palestinians have been killed and thousands more are missing and presumed dead. The Zionist regime siege warfare, the aim of which is to achieve by starvation what could not be achieved by military force, according to civil rights lawyer and writer Dylan Saba, may prove even more deadly than its weapons. A recent Integrated Food Security Phase Classification IPC analysis determined that almost all of Gaza's population of 2.3 million people were enduring extreme hunger and around half were in a situation of catastrophic food insecurity. The international charity Oxfam says that hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in northern Gaza, where the Zionist regime is preventing the UN from delivering aid in violation of recent legally binding decisions by the Security Council and World Court, are forced to survive on an average of 245 calories a day, less than a can of fava beans, since January. Albanese states in her report, A quarter of Gaza's population is at risk of death from preventable health conditions within a year. The Zionist regime's airstrikes, which have obliterated countless Palestinian families in their homes, are carried out with a similarly appalling disregard for human life. According to Plus 972 magazine, an Israeli publication, the military relied on an artificial intelligence program that it developed to target as many as 37,000 Palestinians as suspected militants for possible airstrikes in the first weeks of the war. Human personnel rubber stamped the machine-generated targets with no requirement to thoroughly check why the machine made those choices or to examine the raw intelligence data on which they were based, Plus 972 reported. The targets generated by the artificial intelligence were bombed in homes without hesitation as a first option, an intelligence officer told Plus 972, saying it's much easier to bomb a family's home. The system is built to look for them in these situations. Military sources told the publication that the army preferred to use unguided missiles known as dumb bombs when targeting the people, with one intelligence officer stating that you don't want to waste expensive bombs on unimportant people. Two sources told Plus 972 that for every Hamas fighter that the artificial intelligence system marked, it was permissible to kill up to 15 to 20 civilians. The fact that the Zionist regime's military censors allowed for the publication of the Plus 972 stories suggests that the regime may attempt to place responsibility for the wholesale slaughter of Palestinian civilians on a machine algorithm.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to get rid of diseases in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we are here on A to Z, and we are talking about how to get rid of our diseases in our Islamic lifestyle. Now, of course, we're not talking about medical advice. We're not talking about these physical diseases that an individual comes about, you know, like the cold or a flu or asthma or diabetes, God forbid, or cardiac problems. So we're not talking about those diseases. And just kind of on a side note, though, please, you know, refer to proper medical personnel and receive proper medical attention for these kind of things. But always, when it comes to Islamic medicine, as a part of our Islamic lifestyle, is this idea of prevention, right? So even in the physical diseases, prevention is really important, you know, and there's certain things that you can do, kind of avoid, you know, things that have a lot of sugar, avoid things that have a lot of fat, avoid things that are like fast food, avoid things that are high in sugar content like soda, and of course, you know, walk and have a relatively, you know, healthy lifestyle when it comes to exercise in an appropriate manner, you know. Don't go crazy and start exercising from morning until night, because that also has negative and harmful repercussions and consequences. But anyways, we're talking about getting rid of spiritual diseases. Welcome Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how to get rid of these diseases, and we're not talking about physical diseases, we're talking about spiritual diseases. And we had very quickly said that these spiritual diseases are perhaps more dangerous than physical diseases. Now, you know, if, for example, we have some sort of physical disease that we can't get rid of, well, you know, eventually when you die, you get rid of that physical disease. But spiritual diseases are such that they continue into the next world, and that's an aspect that makes them more dangerous than even physical diseases, right? But when it comes to the spiritual aspect and the spiritual diseases, these are things that continue on into the next world, and that is something that, you know, we really do need to get rid of. Now, we're talking about these diseases. What do we need to do? Well, first and foremost, we need to, sit down and think and list these kind of diseases that we have, and diseases that Islam speaks about, whether, for example, it's lying or backbiting or gossiping, watching bad things or listening to bad things or using swear words or listening to swear words. Or, I mean, there's a whole host, greed and jealousy and carnal desires. There's a whole host of things, you know, out there which, are diseases, and they're spiritual diseases. You list all of these, and then one by one, you find ways to be able to solve these spiritual diseases. One thing, though, before we end the program, is that make sure that you know and you believe from the bottom of your heart that you are able to fix these spiritual diseases, of course, with the help and the grace of the Almighty Allah.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The Zionist regime prison authorities are refusing to return the body of author and activist Walid Daqa to his family following his death in detention on April 7th. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more.
We'll be right back.
The Electronic Intifada wrote, Daka had spent the majority of his life in Israeli custody and was one of the longest-serving Palestinian prisoners. He had been terminally ill with cancer. Israeli regime authorities abducted Daka when he was 24 years old in March 1986 for allegedly participating in armed resistance as a member of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a leftist political party. He was sentenced to life in prison, which was later reduced to 37 years. He completed his 37-year sentence in March 2023. However, in 2018, his detention was extended by 2 years by Israeli regime authorities, citing allegations of smuggling phones into his cell. His new release date had been scheduled for March 2025. Daka hailed from the Palestinian city of Baqa al-Gharbiya, in the occupied territories. He authored multiple books in prison. A Palestinian woman named Sana Salama visited Daka for an interview, and they subsequently became a couple. In 1999, after persistent efforts with the prison authorities, Daka and Salama managed to wed in a legendary celebration at Ascalon Prison in southern occupied territories called Israel. They were joined by a select few of Daka's fellow prisoners, as well as some of their families and friends. Israeli regime prison authorities denied the couple visits despite their prolonged struggle for the right. Despite repeated campaigns by human rights organizations urging Daka's immediate release, the Zionist regime insisted on keeping Daka imprisoned even as he was fighting a rare case of bone marrow cancer. The Palestinian Human Rights Organizations Council, PHROC, which includes a number of groups, sent an urgent appeal last year to the UN Special Procedures, a body that handles such cases, calling for Daka's release. The council said Daka was facing imminent deteriorating health conditions due to Israeli prison services' policy of deliberate medical neglect. Amnesty International similarly called for his release on humanitarian grounds to allow him to spend his remaining time with his family. Amnesty is now calling on Israel to release Daka's body. Erika Juvena Rosas, Amnesty International Senior Director for Research, Advocacy, Policy and Campaign, said, "Even on his deathbed, Israeli authorities continue to display chilling levels of cruelty against Walid Daka and his family, not only denying him adequate medical treatment and suitable food, but also preventing him from saying a final goodbye to his wife Sana Salama and their 4-year-old daughter Milad. Salama could not embrace her dying husband one last time before he passed. The Zionist regime authorities must release Daka's body to his family without delay in order to give him a peaceful and dignified burial and allow them to mourn his death without intimidation." Israeli occupation forces, however, stormed and dismantled the funeral tent where people gathered to mourn Daka. They abducted some of his relatives. Large numbers of Israeli regime forces also raided the home of Daka's family. Israel's far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir publicly endorsed these brutal actions. The minister gave kudos to the Israeli police responsible for dismantling Daka's funeral tent. The minister wrote on X, formerly Twitter, "We are not crying tonight over the death of Daka." He expressed regret that Daka died the supposedly natural death, preferring that he get the death penalty. Daka's death marks the 15th Palestinian fatality in Israeli detention since October 7, 2023, with the Palestinian Prisoners Club attributing these deaths to torture, incarceration, starvation, and medical negligence.
Meanwhile, Palestinians abducted from Gaza and detained in a prison camp are subjected to routine amputations due to severe cough injuries. This disturbing revelation comes from an Israeli field doctor who had worked at the Sere Taiman facility, an army base situated between Beersheba and Gaza in the southern Negev region. Israeli regime authorities abducted Palestinians from Gaza before transferring them to other prisons. The army camp has been turned into a Guantanamo-like prison, according to the human rights group Euromed Human Rights Monitor. The group added detainees there are held in extreme conditions akin to open-air chicken cages without access to food or drink for long periods of time. Just this week, two prisoners had their legs amputated due to handcuff injuries, which unfortunately is a routine event, the physician wrote in a letter to Israeli leaders at the time, which was reported by newspaper Haaretz. Palestinian detainees at Sere Taiman camp are handcuffed 24 hours a day, the newspaper Haaretz reported. This policy came into effect after a medical staffer was allegedly attacked. Handcuffing, which the physician says is on all four limbs, is causing severe injuries that require repeated surgical interventions. Detainees constantly handcuffed are fed through straws and are forced to defecate in diapers. Israeli regime authorities had initially employed plastic handcuffs, but have now replaced them with metal ones. At least one detainee had their hand amputated due to prolonged wear of plastic handcuffs, according to three sources cited by the Israeli newspaper. An Israeli regime military spokesperson declared that no criminal offense was found during an investigation, deciding not to initiate a military police inquiry. Even when patients undergo major operations, they never remain in the hospital for more than a few hours and are transported back to Sere Taiman regardless of post-operative observation. Typically, only one doctor is available at the detention camp, often an orthopedist or other doctors. The physician wrote, this ends in complications and sometimes even in the patient's death. Euromed Monitor interviewed Palestinians from Gaza who had been abducted by Israeli regime forces and reported being subjected to abuse, beatings, threats, stress positions, and other forms of mistreatment that the group says amount to torture. One detainee told the human rights group, recounting being moved from one location to another, every new place had a unique method of torture. He said he was struck in the head by an officer, adding that the severe cold prevented him from sleeping. Another detainee described being forced to completely undress and enduring severe beatings with rocks and rifle butts. He also stated that Israeli regime authorities threatened to rape her family. A female detainee shared a similar account, saying she was forced to undress. She told Euromed Monitor, every time I was stripped, with the female soldiers putting their hands on me while male soldiers occasionally made rude comments. Nearly 1,900 Palestinians have been abducted from Gaza and are still held in the Zionist regime prisons. As of this month, this figure does not include those detained at the Sere Taiman facility, which typically accommodates 600 to 800 individuals.
proxy war between Russia and NATO. In 2022, I spent 5 months living in Russian-controlled Donetsk in the Donbass region. I witnessed firsthand the Ukrainian army targeting and killing civilians whom it claims to be its own citizens. Now, of course, Ukraine has been shelling Donetsk for months now, indeed, intermittently for the last 8 years. When they're not trying to hit military targets, they focus on civilian targets. It is a story that is crucial in understanding the Russia-Ukraine war. I firmly believe that by listening to the experiences of civilians on both sides, the world can better find avenues to peace. Caught on camera, a Ukrainian strike in the center of Donetsk. When I arrived at the scene, the body of 24-year-old Maria Pirogova was still lying on the street, covered in a blanket. Now, while many of the attacks by Ukraine in Donetsk are aimed at civil infrastructure or administration buildings, some are simple terror attacks against civilians. Maria was one of 4 victims of the strike. 2 of the others were musicians. But this strike was nothing special, just another day in Donetsk. Whenever I had no other filming planned, I would simply chase the incoming. Sometimes they would land harmlessly in an empty street. At other times, I would arrive at a bus station or a market with bodies on the pavement and friends and family breaking down in tears. A common occurrence in Donetsk, a nighttime artillery barrage by the Ukrainian army. One of these attacks happened not long after I arrived in May.
I just had a cafe, it's in the evening here in Donetsk. And there was massive incoming. All the civilians and their children ran down to the basement.
As I got closer to the impact site, the realization dawned. The missiles had landed 15 meters outside the front door of my own apartment building. To be honest, it shakes you up. The ambulances, the burnt out cars, my shocked and shaken neighbors. As I walked over the smashed glass into my own apartment, the terror bombing of Donetsk had suddenly become very real.
For the last 2 weeks, I've been interviewing people who've been living under the shelling for the last 8 years, but now to be happening around my area for the Ukrainian government, be targeting this neighborhood really brings home just what it's like to live in an area in which your government is directly shelling you and killing your civilians. But this story is so essential to understand this conflict. And over 10,000 people have been killed here in Donbass over the last 8 years. Over 100 children. Just a few days ago, a child of 5 was killed in her apartment while she was watching TV. And this story of the Ukrainian government intentionally shelling and killing its own civilians over the last 8 years has just not been told in the West.
The school over the road from my apartment was hit, killing 1. And a school on the neighboring street killing 4. Rare was a day in 2022 without casualties. One day I was out filming in the adjoining city of Makiivka. We were told of a child recently killed and we stumbled upon her funeral. Her body in display in an open casket. Her neighbors and friends gathered to say their goodbyes and to support the family. At the gravesite, not a dry eye. A child killed in war is a special tragedy. A few days later, I went to speak to another family of a child killed. They shouted at me and told me to leave. Boris Johnson, Macron, you did this. Shame on you. Increasingly, NATO is supplying the weapons to kill their children. Alina is only one of more than 150 children killed by Ukrainian shelling in 8 years of war here. This footage was taken in 2014. A Ukrainian jet drops a bomb in the center of Luhansk. 8 civilians were killed. Unable to win on the battlefield, Ukraine resorted to bombing civilians in an attempt to dampen local support for the so-called pro-Russian separatists. It didn't work, instead strengthening people's resolve to declare independence and in 2022 to vote to join Russia. This is the Alley of Angels, a monument set up dedicated to the slaughter of children by Ukraine. And here in Oktoberski district, another monument to fallen civilians. The toys are for the children. While increasingly the slaughter of civilians by Ukraine is dismissed as Russian propaganda, here it is simply the reality.
A man just came up to me while I was filming And I told him that I was British, and he said, "Ah, yes, there are lots of people like you here in the last 8 years who came and ate at the best restaurants. We're supposed to be telling the world what's been going on here, i.e. the deaths of all these people." But he said they never told the truth. But back in 2014, there was some honest reporting. This is a piece by CNN.
"In this city, as the people of Donetsk sweep up the debris of their homes and livelihoods, they are hardened against a president they say is killing his own people. We are Ukrainian, but they kill us, this man says, so we probably need our own country, because these people in Kiev, they are not brothers for us. The shells hit these homes days ago.
Two people were killed outside this block of flats last Wednesday. One of them was a 50-year-old woman, the other a 34-year-old woman. Her husband, who won't talk to us, he says he's in shock, managed to make it down to the cellar with their little child, but she just didn't have the time. And this is a story that repeats itself over and over in dozens of apartment blocks, with civilians being killed by the constant shelling around Donetsk."
But over the years, journalists stopped coming, and the bombing of civilians became Russian propaganda. The only journalists who remained were a motley crew of independent journalists like Patrick Lancaster, Eva Bartlett, and German journalist Alina Lipp, who came to Donbass in the summer of 2021, long before Russia sent its army into Ukraine.
"Ukraine was intentionally killing civilians before February 22. There were a lot of cases where, in fact, really snipers intentionally killed people who were on their way to work or somewhere else. It happened quite a lot. And this wasn't a mistake. This was really intentionally. And I've seen also schools who were destroyed in those districts. First, I thought that this is more a conflict between soldiers, so who kill each other, and not soldiers killing civilians."
In a worrying trend, journalists who do come to Donbass are increasingly facing persecution in European countries for doing so. Alina is facing 3 years imprisonment in Germany for her reporting, and has had multiple hit pieces written about her. Instead of reporting on the killing of civilians in Donbass, some outlets are resorting to attacking those who do. Others have had their bank accounts closed. I head to the front line on the outskirts of Donetsk with one of the Donbass militias. Ukrainian soldiers are only 100 meters away. The soldier stops as he thinks he hears a drone. Both sides are dropping grenades on each other. Our position is hit by a rocket-propelled grenade, and we are rushed underground. Europeans are once again slaughtering each other in the trenches in another brutal and unnecessary war. At its root, this is a civil war between Ukrainian nationalists who came to power in Kiev in 2014 and its pro-Russian population. The divisions in the country have been exploited to create a proxy war between NATO and Russia. As a result, dozens, often hundreds of soldiers on both sides are dying every day. While Russian casualty figures are high, Ukrainian losses are estimated to be many times higher due to Russia's overwhelming air and artillery superiority. Ukrainian men of fighting age are not allowed to leave the country, and the cemeteries are filling up. Well over 100,000 dead so far is the likely figure. NATO is fighting Russia to the last Ukrainian, a phrase often used, is proven correct. I hear this a lot in Donbass, that there is a genocide going on. In the West, it's dismissed as Russian propaganda, but it's difficult to argue with people who have lived under the shelling of civilians for 8 years. In 2014, the then president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, made a speech which is etched into the minds of people in Donbass. At the school around the corner from my apartment in Donetsk, hit by Ukraine, I spoke to the parents of children who attended the school.
"As a civilian, you get used to the shelling somehow. As soon as it's coming closer, of course, you're starting to be afraid. But usually, I mean, you hear it from the morning to the evening, shelling in your city. So you still have to buy your products. Of course, you have some meetings, you go to the restaurant, and you just keep on with your normal life. But there's always a kind of a pressure. You always think about when you're walking through the streets, okay, there's a lot of glass now of the shops, I shouldn't be going there, or I should go better this street because this street was hit a lot in the last days. So there's always thinking about this war, about the fact that you could die any minute, and this is making a lot with you and making a lot with the families who live there. I mean, they can't plan their future. There are a lot of children not being born because of the war, and this is not very being seen in the West, I think, how hard it is for the people who live there already for 8 years.
Pushkin Boulevard in the center of Donetsk, back when Ukraine was refraining from hitting the center of the city.
Now, I was just in a hotel lobby near here just a few minutes ago. Huge explosions. Most people ran down to the basement. I've come to the scene right now. This is Pushkin Boulevard. This is essentially the beautiful pedestrian walkway in the center of Donetsk. Civilians walk here every day, strolling on their time off on a Sunday afternoon. This is an attack on civilian areas. There's nothing new here. They've been bombing the city all day today, like they do every day, the Ukrainians. This is just a pedestrian street on a Sunday afternoon that they target.
And around the corner, a cafe I used to frequent often.
This is Cafe Onegin. This is in the center of Donetsk. It was hit by a Ukrainian missile, just landed just outside these windows about 20 minutes ago. Now, I was literally myself sitting right here about 45 minutes ago, trying to take the morning off watching World Cup football. And that's the reality of people living in Donetsk. At any moment, these missiles can land. Thankfully, nobody was killed in this strike.
Markets, too, are often hit. Increasingly, NATO weaponry and ammunition are being used.
The Ukrainians were told that people who live in the Donbas area are not really people anymore, that they are stupid, they are workers in coal mines and so on, and they are pro-Russian. And so they were kind of, you could say, brainwashed in the last 8 years by their own government. The government started to prohibit the Russian language and so on. They were told that it would be better that if every Russian would be dead. And this is why they think they are doing a good thing, actually, by killing Russians.
In September, a referendum was held in Donbass on whether to join Russia. In the West, it was dismissed as illegal and as a sham. But as anyone who has spent any time in Donetsk will know, the vast majority here supported it and voted to join Russia. What has become a proxy war between Russia and NATO is, at its root, a civil war. It is clear from my many months in Donbass that the vast majority no longer wish to be part of Ukraine and wish instead to be part of the Russian Federation. There is a peace to be had. The views of the civilians on both sides are listened to and respected.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.